This episode of Datanauts is brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/datanauts and use the code datanauts30.
Welcome, loyal listeners. I am Chris Wall. You can follow me at Chris Wall. And with me is my co-host who uses a GPS watch the size of a small city. That's Ethan Banks. He's at EC Banks on the Twitters. This is the Datanauts podcast. You can find this and all of our shows on iTunes, your favorite podcatcher, or at packofpushers.net. We normally have this fancy-dancy space theme intro thing, but there's so much content here, I wanted to get right to it. So real quick, let me check in on Ethan. How you doing, buddy? You feeling pumped?
Back from Vegas, the life of shiny and plastic, and I'm back home in New Hampshire in my studio where things are real. Pumped? You know it.
Got it. So it doesn't smell like suntan lotion like it does in Mandalay constantly.
Nor does it smell like smoke, alcohol, and sadness. No.
One of the three. Okay. Well, today I'm very, very excited to have someone who I've been following for a very long time. He's a titan of industry, a captain of blogging, lord of something else. I don't know. Lots of cool stuff. We have Scott Lowe. He's at Scott_Lowe on the Twitters, blog.scottlowe.org. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Thanks, Chris and Ethan. I appreciate it.
You're like the barometer of what's going to happen in future technology. So I've been a longtime reader, and we're going to dive into a lot of things that are hopefully top of mind for you and technology focus and things like that. Let's start with, for those that don't know who you are, there's probably one or two people left in the world. Can you tell us a little bit about your career, what you're doing today, and what your professional work has been focused on?
Sure, absolutely. Although I think you're probably overestimating the number of people who don't know who I am. I've been in the industry quite a while. We've all started out where there's a few, you know, kind of odd jobs, and we're not really sure when we transition into IT sort of officially. I marketed about 20 years or so that I've been in the field. Started out as an instructor, moved on to becoming a technical trainer. I was actually a Microsoft certified trainer for a while doing the MCSE courses and did that for a number of years, and then moved into a couple different roles with resellers and such on the East Coast, typical SE, installing stuff, configuring stuff, setting up servers and storage arrays and what all. Moved into the vendor space in 2010. I went to work for EMC, working with Chad Sakach and the vSpecialist team. And then in 2013, I joined VMware in my current role, which is on the NSX team, focusing on network virtualization, software-defined networking to a lesser extent, but we can talk more about that later, and sort of how it plays with the open source world.
Yeah, do you still have the vSpecialist bowling shirt?
Oh, yeah, I remember those shirts. You know, I think I might have one in storage somewhere. I honestly don't remember.
Okay. They were pretty unique. I remember seeing them and, oh, you're obviously a vSpecialist, even though I don't know.
Obviously, yeah.
Yeah. So what I want to talk about first, as someone who's read your content for a number of years, you know, originally, a lot of the focus was on kind of discovering the virtualization world of VMware. A lot of focus seemed to be on how to build a vSphere environment, how to troubleshoot, configure. It was very techie around VMware. And then maybe 2-3 years ago, I noticed a shift to, I'm just calling it open source projects. Some of it was Nicira, but you seem to make a shift there. So open source, so why the focus on this? What's the secret with open source and those kind of projects? And why are you focusing so heavily on that now?
That's a great question. And it is interesting to see the shift. It actually occurred right around 2012. And that was when I sort of consciously made the decision that I was going to focus less on VMware specific stuff and move more into things sort of around network virtualization. Although I didn't really understand that at the time, I had this thread of things that I wanted to explore that I thought there was really something there that was going to be important. And as I started pulling on that thread and unraveling what was connected there, that's what led me into things like Open vSwitch, and then eventually into my role with VMware around network virtualization and open source. So my interest in open source initially was just piqued by, like I said, this sort of connection that I had about these technologies I was hearing. The more that I heard about these technologies, the more that I dug into them, the more that I felt like there was really something there. I'd been sort of a, I guess I'll say, a closet open source enthusiast for a while. You know, I played with Linux back in the late 90s, as did many of us, right? And loved it and thought it was great. But even today, it's hard to get anything done using Linux on your desktop because you need apps. You need to actually get work done, right? And so it wasn't until some point later on when I had the opportunity to spend more time with Linux in a server role than as a desktop role, I was like, okay, now this is where I can really put this to use, is where I can really do some fascinating things. That coupled with the fact that my employer needed me to focus on the open source stuff really was what led me to be so seemingly focused on open source right at the time.
Well, my follow-up with that, would be, you're obviously focused on it. It sounds like your employer is happy that that's happening. That's a desire that they have. To me, the third leg of this stool is, why would you say other businesses seem suddenly so interested in open source? It's shifted from this kind of, you will never bring open source into the enterprise, to how many open source projects can we cram into the enterprise and survive?
Yeah, and I think there's been a little bit of an over-rotation because, well, we've all probably heard the term open washing, where, you know, you take some code that you wrote and you throw it on GitHub and you say, woohoo, we're open source, right? And there's a lot more to being successful in open source than that. I think the thing is that we've gotten to a point where there are some really, really powerful building blocks that are open source, that are solid, that are able to be reused and combined in other ways to make really compelling solutions. The rise of these things being used kind of extensively in a variety of ways, suddenly somebody, you know, opened the door and shone the light on how all these projects were being used and all the different places the projects were being used. And it was like, oh, wow, we can do a lot more than this than perhaps we realized. And that's, I think, why a lot of organizations, a lot of businesses are suddenly saying, hey, let's work in the open, develop our code in the open, or let's leverage open source as a part of a bigger solution or something of that nature.
Yeah, it's kind of felt like keeping up with the Joneses a little bit. If everyone else is doing it, you feel left behind if you're not doing it, but also perhaps a way to get some easy contributions to the projects, which kind of brings me to another question that I had. As an ops person, I don't consider myself a developer at all. You had some commentary or maybe actually a post on how to contribute to open source, and it seemed like the trick was to start with documentation. Can you comment on that and how that's worked out so far?
Well, I'm very much like you, Chris. I do not consider myself a developer. I would say I'm even farther back on that curve than you are and desperately need to catch up as soon as I can figure out how to make 32 hours in a day. I guess the thing is, personally, I feel like there's a lot of value if you are community-minded in open source. Again, there's lots of different ways to handle open source. And in some cases, there is some keeping up with the Joneses, like we're going to create an open source project just because everybody else has one. But to really make a difference, to really make an impact, it's about creating something that solves a need that a broader community has and then working in the benefit of the broader community, not just for your own organization, right? And when you do that, then you can create a project that pulls together multiple organizations that might commercially have not necessarily aligning priorities, right? Because they're all going after some similar portion of the market. But because this solution has value for all of them, then you can begin to build something that's actually successful rather than just tossing some code over the wall and saying, here, it's open source. And, you know, why would people bother to contribute to that? Because it doesn't offer them any value. You're just asking people to do your work for free. When you are successful in building this sort of open source community, and I look at examples like Open vSwitch, which is just a really vibrant community with a lot of different contributors from a lot of different organizations, then it draws people in. And when you begin to use it and you say, wow, this is a really powerful tool, you begin to want to contribute to make it better, right? And not being a programmer and instead being someone, I guess, you know, if I had to put a label on myself, I would say I'm a writer, then the most natural place for me to say, hey, if I want to make a difference and you take what talent I have and put it in the community, and that becomes documentation. And so I tried to help through blog posts and other methods showing people there are ways to contribute. Some communities are a little more, let's say, accepting of non-programmers contributing than others. That's, again, sort of a community thing. For me personally, I've had a bit of success in making some contributions to a number of different open source projects along the documentation front, Open vSwitch being one, Terraform, a couple others. But it is, I think, a reasonable place to start for someone who is just getting into the community for a couple of the reasons. One of the reasons is that as a newcomer to a community, you see things in a way that people who have been involved in the community from the very beginning aren't going to see them. And therefore, you have a perspective that is very valuable to helping other newcomers enter that same community, right? So a brand new user to Open vSwitch or Open Virtual Network or OpenStack or any of these other open source projects looks at things a certain way. And if he or she can be encouraged to contribute to the documentation in such a way that would help other newcomers rather than looking at the people who have been in this from the very beginning and kind of just intuitively know how this stuff works, it's a different sort of feel.
It's funny you talk about documentation as a way to contribute if you're a non-coder. You've been looking at open source projects. I've been looking at standards bodies. So I've been trying to find a home in the IETF, some project in there that I can contribute to. And I think that would largely be my contribution, not documentation as such, but more going through drafts, editing, fixing, changing, fixing for readability, making sure the use cases are making sense and are clear, those sorts of things. I just got to find the right project to land on. What projects are you interested in, Scott? What maybe are there projects at an early stage that you're keeping tabs on?
Well, I would consider myself more of, I don't know if you guys are familiar with this. I first heard it from Simon Wardley, but it's the whole pioneer, settler, town planner sort of approach. I consider myself probably falling more in the settler approach. I'm not really so incredibly bleeding edge that I'm out here with these really, really crazy projects that are just now being launched. Instead, I find these projects that have now come to a certain level of maturity, and I'm like, oh, okay, I can take this. I can see where this fills a gap in somebody's data center lineup, and now I'm going to try and take this and make it consumable for other people, right? A lot of the projects that I spend my time on, both from a matter of what naturally fit into my expertise and where my employer wants me to go, wouldn't necessarily be early stage projects. You know, I spend a lot of time at OpenStack, but then again, you know, who doesn't, right? Open vSwitch, Open Virtual Network. Everybody, of course, is involved in Docker. And so I'm involved there as well. Kubernetes. But these are all very, very well known. So I don't know that there's any like sort of really early stage ones that I've picked up yet. My sort of bent in how I look at things, I think my radar, if you will, doesn't really pick things up until they've sort of hit a certain momentum. I don't know if that makes any sense or not.
No, it does. And as you cited, those major projects, OVS, OVN, Kubernetes, I think you said OpenStack as well, those have all got a lot of momentum, a lot of people talking about them. They all have very specific use cases, very well defined, people doing a lot of work with them. Do you think that means all of those projects are going to last into the future? Because a lot of those projects also have competing projects that do very similar things, and it's kind of hard to know from an outside perspective where to land, which project to pick.
You're absolutely right. We could have a whole podcast about OpenStack. So we'll just kind of leave that a go. I think it really comes down, in my opinion, right? It really comes down to the community. The OpenStack community is very, very large, but at the same time, their processes and their procedures make it really difficult for people to come in and contribute. And I understand why they have these processes in place, and it's designed to help code contributions and ensure quality and all that kind of stuff. And I totally get it, but it just, the whole tool chain just makes it really, really difficult. Where on the other hand, I was able to go in and make some contributions to Terraform, which is an automation tool, multi-platform automation tool that HashiCorp produces. And I was able to make those contributions and add some content there very, very easily, very, very quickly. I think it really comes down to the community is, you know, what does the tool chain look like? How easy is it for people to kind of get ramped up into that project? When you begin to look at the project, it doesn't take a whole lot to begin to figure out, is this project, does it have a sort of vibrant life of its own versus is it another one of these things that somebody has tossed over the wall and said it's open source, now let's call people in to contribute for free and do our work for us? I mean, not that I found anyway, no hard, fast rule that says this is how you would pick one. There are a lot of great projects out there, and I think there's probably a ton of projects that are very, very worthy and have great communities, but just haven't gotten the sort of visibility and momentum that maybe some of the others have.
Well, speaking of hard and fast rules to pick one or the other, I wanted to tease apart your brain a little bit on something that's come up quite a few times, this whole containers versus virtual machines thing that keeps floating around. They're often positioned as one or the other. Do you believe in this? Can they live together in harmony and sing kumbaya? Or is it actually a zero-sum game and we're all going to be living under the container overlords here soon?
I'll share my view, but at the same time, when I share my view, because I work for VMware, and even though, you know, none of my opinions are formed by VMware or approved by VMware or whatever, that just the fact that I have that association naturally means that people are going to take my conclusion and make some assumptions out of it.
Everyone is biased. There's no such thing as non-bias. So
absolutely. But my particular conclusion is that for at least the next few years, I think that you're going to need both. I think that the whole idea of pitting them against each other is something that we in IT do a lot. And we create these false dichotomies where it has to be one or the other, instead of looking at this in a more holistic view and saying, okay, which tool is most appropriate for the job? It's the whole Linux versus Windows. I mean, it's not a matter of which one's better. They are different. They have different strengths. They have different purposes. You can use them both to solve the challenges that you need to solve, right?
Why would you say both, though, Scott, at this point? Is that because our legacy applications don't necessarily map that well to a container-style infrastructure?
That's a great question. One, containers currently, and I say currently because there's lots of work going on, but we don't know how far out it's going to take before that stuff sort of kind of hits the mainstream. Currently, containers can't provide the same level of isolation that a virtual machine can provide. Now, like I said, there's lots of work going on there. We could talk about Rocket's KVM stage one work that Intel did and Intel Clear Containers. And so there's pieces on the chessboard, so to speak, that are moving that may change that. But for now, if you really want multi-tenant isolation, you need to do that at a virtual machine layer. The second reason I would say that is because virtual machines have become a ubiquitous method of consumption. Like when I go to Amazon, even if I'm running ECS, which is Amazon's container service, Amazon themselves provide that via EC2 instances. So basically a virtual machine has become just a way of creating a server. It's HP, IBM, virtual machine. These are just ways of consuming capacity. It's not necessarily because one technology is better than the other. They have different purposes, different uses. That's why I kind of think that they're going to live together for a while. It may be as we progress with this whole serverless sort of thing and functions as a service and others that those abstractions begin to move in such a way that we no longer see them. And that's fine. But for now, I think at least for the next few years, you're going to see both. You're going to need both. You're going to use both. And of course, there is still the legacy application piece, which is certainly not to be ignored.
So Scott, another focus of yours since you're working on the NSX team has been software-defined networking. We seem to be at a point with SDN where we've kind of quit talking about SDN and it's more about use cases and what we can get done with it. What do you think is interesting about SDN and how are you seeing people use it? Do you actually find value in the term at this point and so on?
I personally don't find a whole lot of value in the term. I think it's become too overused. It's like open washing, right? We see so many people who are using the term SDN to apply to a lot of different things, whether it be adding APIs to network operating systems or network automation or anything else. So for me personally, I don't find a whole lot of value in it. And that's why I tend to focus more on the network virtualization term, because I think for a lot of people, that's clearer in saying this is what the product does, right? Now, that being said, there are a lot of folks out there who still find value in that, and that's fine. Anytime I have a conversation when somebody says, hey, we want to talk about SDN, I usually ask then, okay, well, can you dig into that a little bit? Because SDN by itself is a little broad, a little amorphous. Can you talk a little bit more about what it is you're trying to do? And then once we can look at the use case and what it is they're trying to do, then we can begin to figure out what are the appropriate projects or products or whatever that fit here. So,
yeah, it's like saying, I like transportation. Wonderful. Did you want a semi-tractor trailer truck? Did you want a bus? Do you want a car? What are you trying to do exactly? Saying I want SDN isn't a thing anymore. Do you think everyone's going to be doing SDN in some flavor at some point? x86 kind of ate the world. Or do you just think SDN is going to be maybe the rich companies and big companies or pocket use cases? Or
I'll kind of toss it back to you and say, do you think everybody's going to be using transportation at some point? Right.
Right? Fair enough.
Nice.
Yeah, everybody will be using SDN in some fashion. It's what it is that's going to be doing. So is it going to be network virtualization? Is it going to be some type of security functionality? We could use the term micro-segmentation or similar, right? Is it SD-WAN or similar things? Is it something else that we haven't even realized yet? Is it network automation? I mean, I think all of these things are going to continue to grow. And so when you say, you know, is everyone going to be using SDN? I think the answer is yes. It'll just be, what does that particular implementation of SDN look like for that particular customer? I think you'll see network virtualization will have its own sort of niche. It won't necessarily be the fit for all customers. Security, micro-segmentation type things, I think, have a much broader appeal and could go to potentially any size, any organization. Other flavors of SDN, network automation, APIs, et cetera, I think they'll just continue to be pushed because that's kind of the way all industries are headed in the technology field. I think the answer to that is yes. It'll just be a matter of what flavor, what variety does that look like.
As I was listening to Scott reflecting on his experience with different open source projects, which I've shied away from just for time or just, you know, fear of how the heck do I get into this world that already exists and everything, and it's always seemed a little intimidating, and I just haven't made the time to go into it. But one of the things he said really stuck out to me, which was every project has its own culture. He was talking about, for example, how OpenStack might be a little hard to get into because of all the processes and procedures that they have around things. I've seen some of the same things with standards, whereas I've been trying to get into the IETF and find a group that's working on something that I can be interested in and actually have something of value to offer. The ones I've checked out so far, it's just like, it's not a fit for me, the way they work and the way they talk and the use cases they're discussing. And I think that's reasonable to point out. Not every project will be a fit for you, but something will be. So if you really want to contribute to the wider IT community in the form of projects or standards, just keep at it. Something will happen. And I'm going to keep at it with the IETF until I find a home. What about you, Chris?
Hey, culture's king, man. It definitely dictates how things are going to happen and how much gravity, I guess, can draw in talent and such for a project. And What I was thinking was, as an ops person, there are still ways you can get involved and contribute. You don't have to be a developer. Obviously, depending on the vibe of the project, it sounds like some of them are more open to that idea than others. But just keep in mind that documentation is a somewhat frictionless way to start, and that you have awesome perspectives and great experience that can bring value to the project in very unique ways. So don't shy away just because you don't know how to write in Go or something like that. Although you can learn that too, but the experiences that you've had as an ops person is definitely worth its weight in gold.
Datanauts has great sponsors that make the show possible. One of them is IT Pro TV. I know you've heard from them before, but based on my review of their site, content, and delivery system, I believe it's a solid certification training platform. There's lots of content there, well over 1,000 hours, and you can consume it any way you want to, including devices like Roku and Apple TV. You can even buy via Amazon Video Direct if that appeals to you. The training material offered is likely what you're looking for. Microsoft Server 2016 MCSE, check. Certified Ethical Hacker, check. Cisco, CCNA Security, absolutely, and lots more. And it's not just training, by the way. IT Pro TV also throws in over 100 labs, as well as Transcenter practice exams, so that you have a pretty good sense of when you're really ready to make an official exam attempt. With IT Pro TV, you don't buy a course, you get access to the entire library via a reasonable monthly subscription. Both individual and group pricing options are available. If you change your mind or cash gets tight, you can cancel with no hassle. Check out itpro.tv/datanauts to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 per year, but we have a special offer. Try it free for 7 days when you sign up using our code DATANAUTS30 to check out their courses, live stream, and more. You'll also receive 30% off the lifetime of your account. That's less than $40 per month or $399 for the entire year. Just visit itpro.tv/datanauts, use the code DATANAUTS30, and try it free for 7 days, plus save 30% off the life of your account.
You categorize yourself as a writer, and you do seem to consume and share a huge amount of information on tech. I envy the frequency and depth with which you blog. I end up doing most of my work personally on podcasting. I struggle to get the writing out the door some days. How do you prioritize your work and get it all in your brain?
Oh, I would say that I don't, because it always feels like I'm not successful at it. You know, I mean, it always feels like there's so much more that I haven't tackled. It's actually a struggle to make sure that I stay limited to things that are really, really relevant. I suppose it could be described as a variety of technology-centric ADD, ADHD, whatever. I don't remember. There you go. Case in point. What I have done is I've kind of tried to structure it around a couple of things. One, I structured around what makes sense for synergy with my day job, which obviously that makes a lot of sense, right? And then what I find also not only useful for the day job, but the near future out, like what do I think is really going to hit the mainstream 18 to 24 months from now, somewhere in there. I don't always get it right, but sometimes I do. And then what plays to the expertise that I or have already developed, as well as to the expertise that I want to develop moving forward. That's where my focus is and how I gather the information and then do something with it.
Let me drill into that on more of a day-to-day basis. I mean, how do you prioritize when you've got 15 things on your mind? You've got VMware stuff and, you know, the BU that you support, and I'm assuming customer engagements and then speaking engagements. Do you have a day-to-day way that you make sure you get everything done that you're trying to get done?
I have a system that I use, sort of a to-do system. I blogged about it before, a combination of a modified getting things done sort of approach that tracks not only my involvement in various open source projects, but also my work responsibilities and also my personal responsibilities, because, you know, I do have a personal life. Yeah, I know. It's amazing, isn't it? And so I use that as sort of a framework around which I structure what I need to do, that in conjunction with the typical sort of calendar of these are the calls that I have to make and the customer meetings that I have to go to and so on and so forth, events where I'm speaking, et cetera, et cetera. And between the two, that's sort of my productivity stack, if you will, of managing what my obligations are, things that I know that I need to do, as well as things that I want to do, and then the timelines around those, and then sort of my time obligations of who I need to talk to when or where I need to be when, those play together. And then it's just a matter of constantly being on it, of fighting that urge to get pulled off into some rabbit hole, which I don't always succeed in
I should check Twitter. People might be saying something that's interesting.
Yeah. Yes.
Squirrel. Yeah,
exactly.
My system seems very similar to yours, Scott. I live by my calendar and then Wunderlist. I have a fairly complex system in Wunderlist of things I need to get done and then prioritizing what I need to get done this week, which has 17 items on it so far as we record this on a Monday morning.
I know how you feel.
Much easier. I just follow you two.
Good luck with that, Chris.
Seems to work out so well. One quote that I kind of like that I saw floating out on the Twitterverse was, "Don't cling to a mistake just because you spend a lot of time making it." So my question to you, Scott, is you've got this list of priorities. There's only so much time in the day and so much energy you can focus towards projects and things like that. So many squirrel moments you can have. How do you decide when to bail on a project because it's not showing return on your investment or your time is just better spent elsewhere? When you cut something from the list?
That's a really tough thing to decide. And I don't know that there's a single sort of set of criteria that I could say this is how it determines. It's really a case-by-case basis. For me, I have to look at, am I able to make an impact in this area, in this community, whether it be an open source community where I want to engage or contribute, whether it be a project, a topic that I want to blog about or anything of that nature. Can I make an impact? If I can't make an impact, and I'm saying that make an impact, not because I want to, ooh, I'm the big guy kind of thing. It's more like, am I going to be able to be effective? Can I actually contribute something that would be useful to someone rather than just another voice? Right.
Got it.
Part of it's that. Part of it is it comes down to time. It's like, okay, there are things that you have to do. You know, there's the day job that pays the bills and you have to get that stuff done. And then there's the stuff you'd like to do. When it comes down to that, it's like, well, what you got to do, right? Yeah. So there's no one single sort of thing that says, this is how I decide. It's, can I be effective? Can I make a difference? Can I make something easier for other people by contributing to this community or project or topic? If I can't, then maybe it just becomes sort of a back burner thing I track until I am able to be effective there. Maybe it just becomes something like, okay, it's a casualty. It's something that I would really, really like to be able to be involved in, but I simply don't have the resources to do it. And therefore, it's a bummer, but it is what it is.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of times where you're tweeting out, like, I tried installing XYZ project, it's not working. And I know for me personally, when I hit that moment, and then I also go to either the project owner or the owners, there's no documentation, the pulse or whatever it's called in GitHub is pretty stale in there, then I tend to bail. Because there's nothing worse than seeing this really cool blob of code and trying to use it, and you can't figure it out, and there's no documentation, and you just want to go, blah, what's wrong with these people? That's been my ejection point.
Yeah, that's absolutely spot on, and I'm glad you mentioned that. I mean, certainly there are some metrics that you can use, like the activity of a community on GitHub, the responsiveness of a community, either through their mailing lists or GitHub issues or IRC. These are all various ways that you can kind of assess how responsive is this community, how open are they to new users or to new contributions, those sort of things. And certainly that does make a difference.
Now, Scott, one of the projects that you took on was podcasting. You started a podcast called The Full Stack Journey. You started a podcast, man. That's a big undertaking. What inspired you to take that on? It was kind of a big commitment.
Huge commitment. And I'm now questioning whether I really should have done that commitment. I talked about it when I launched the podcast, The Full Stack Journey, which recently I finally got around to launching its own website, fullstackjourney.com. And you can go there and get access to the podcast episodes. And of course, it's on iTunes as well. But one of the things I wanted to do is I've been blessed to be able to write, and writing comes fairly naturally for me. So I don't have to like really, really struggle with it. Some people really, really struggle with writing. And so it's very difficult for them. But for me, writing came very naturally and still does. And I'm thankful for that. I wanted to sort of stretch myself beyond where I was already, not to pat myself on the back, but a reasonably successful blogger. I wanted to kind of see what other sort of means are there for me to be able to reach folks about something that I feel is important. And what I feel is important is how we as a community within IT are developing in our careers. And I think this idea of being a one area specialist, its days are numbered. When I looked at that and I looked at kind of how it made sense and where the industry was going with the rise of certain technologies and certain ways of deploying applications and stuff, I felt like this was kind of the right spot to step in and see if I could make a difference, see if I could be effective. Kind of going back to what we talked about earlier, like, how do you know when to bail on something? It's, you know, can I be effective? And so I wanted to try and see if I could be effective in making a difference for folks who are out there. Maybe they're hardcore networking folks and they're wondering what their career looks like. Maybe they're server admins. Maybe they're hardcore vSphere, VMware folks, and they're looking at all these other technologies out there and saying, okay, now what do I do? I felt like it was a way for me to be able to speak to people who are wondering about their career and say, look, this is where we have examples of people moving in this direction and examples of technologies that are feeding this. And I think this is an important thing for you to consider as you move forward.
Yeah, the world is a scary, ever-changing place. I remember when x86 virtualization was introduced, that was both exciting and new, and a whole bunch of things had to be learned. This full stack idea, it's also kind of scary a little bit, I think, for a lot of ops folks, having to stretch their legs and their arms and their noodles, your brain, into different verticals within the organization. I'm curious, in your perspective, what is a full stack person or engineer?
So I will freely admit that other people may disagree with my use of the term full stack, and that's fair. What I envisioned as a full stack engineer is somebody who, they're not quite a generalist. I just had this discussion in one of the episodes that I recorded. I can't remember if I published it yet or not, but I just had this discussion. It's not quite a generalist. It's more of somebody who, you have an area of expertise that you have developed and created over time, and now you're deliberately sort of reinventing yourself, intentionally moving into other areas so that you are somebody who has one or two, maybe three areas of significant expertise and a reasonable level of knowledge about all the other stuff and the ability to look at this very holistically and say, okay, I don't know the answer to that, but I'm not going to push it off on somebody else. I'm going to help find the answer to that. So we're going to go talk to this guy over here or this gal over here or this team over here until we do this. It's a combination of both technical skill and business awareness. It kind of takes some of the cultural things of DevOps without the association that people often make when you use that term DevOps, right? Which has its own connotations and conclusions that people make when you mention that term, saying, look, I'm somebody who's in here. I'm here to solve a problem for the business. I'm not about saying, hey, not my problem because I'm the server guy, or not my problem because I'm the storage gal, or not my problem because I'm the networking girl. It's more than that. I don't know if that helps at all.
You think the world is changing that much for operations? I mean, are you seeing that everywhere? Are you seeing some companies kind of like, yeah, whatever, silos are great. We kind of like them. We're used to that in our processes. Or are you really seeing a move for everybody to change?
I think we're on the early stage yet of seeing a really, really strong move for people to change. I might be a little ahead of the curve here, but I really do feel like there's a combination of factors that are going to really lead people down this path. And one of them is public cloud and the ever-increasing presence and pressure, justified in some cases, not necessarily justified in other cases, to leverage public cloud resources. And I think as that trend continues, and I think it will continue, and as the intensity to create sort of more automated private infrastructure continues to intensify, that we are naturally going to be forced a little more up the stack than where we have been. And this is going to cause us to need to diversify our skills. It's going to need to cause us to look more at automation, to look more at a holistic approach of how things go, rather than saying, I'm the server gal, I'm an infrastructure person, but infrastructure doesn't necessarily mean hardware, right? Infrastructure might be resources that I'm getting from Amazon or Google or Azure. Like I said, I freely admit I might be a little ahead of the curve here, but I do believe that we are going to have to change.
It's interesting, regardless of how you want to learn new content, and this especially after hearing both you, Ethan, and Scott on how you learn, I think the major takeaway there is that it's important to have some sort of system, that you have to track what you want to learn, you have to prioritize that content, and the old adage that without measurement, you can't improve, you know, metrics are important, and that applies to any endeavor, and learning is certainly no different. What are you thinking, Ethan?
Scott made a point at the end that we've kind of made on Datanauts before, and in a sense, it's the whole point of the podcast that we're doing, and it's being a one-trick pony. You only know the one thing and you live in your silo. That's kind of a short-timer's career at this point. IT requires systems-level expertise to contribute the most and to be the most effective in your job. You can't understand merely your one silo. You really should have an understanding of what's going on throughout the data center across silos. And I thought it was fascinating, Scott's point, that public cloud is what's taking people down this road. If you're going to consume public cloud, it forces you to understand a lot of these other processes, no matter what silo you're in. Not just that, but private cloud too. You know, he mentioned private infrastructures and automating that private infrastructure, and all of that is taking us up the stack from wherever we were to where we really need to be. There's a holistic approach now, an automated approach. And he pointed out, yeah, maybe that's a little early in the curve, but he sees that as something that's going to transform all of IT eventually, which is my thought as well. Eventually, we're all going to be living in this new world.
All right, so we know what you're currently focusing on, and we've gotten into your mind a little bit, Scott, which is both awesome and scary, I suppose. But I have a little bit of a rant, and I hope we can pick apart this snark just a little bit. And that is, whatever happened to just standing up some servers, tying them to a storage array, plumbing it all together with a network, and then just telling your users, hey, if you want something, it's going to be 4 to 6 months. How did we lose our grips on this golden age of the wonderful world of slow and painful IT? Where did that go?
One answer for you, Amazon.
You're talking about the fact that I can get 2-day shipping with Prime for free? Is that the...
Either. Take your pick, right?
But seriously, it's when we talk about the major changes that have occurred, you know, that was the world that I was kind of introduced to with IT, was that a major project would be 6 months minimum, perhaps years to get off the ground, and it was going to be riddled with bugs, and you'd just spend years chasing them down. If you want a server, it's going to be months and months and months minimal. When we talk about change, I think that's the big driver towards how the feeling of change has accelerated so quickly, because literally we did go slow back then. The speed of IT was orders of magnitude slower. Now we're just challenged to provide so much with so little. It's a daunting thing.
Oh, I completely agree. And you're absolutely accurate in calling out the difference. I mean, for a lot of us that have been in the industry for a while, we were in that space, and it is very different than what is expected now. And I don't know if that's part of sort of the whole technology bubble thing that happened in the late 90s and early 2000s. I think what we see now is that businesses have a very different expectation from their technology departments than we had in the past. And now, because there are alternatives that may be very, very viable in a number of instances, the businesses, rightfully so, I don't fault them for this, are holding IT departments accountable to say, you know, no, that's not good enough anymore. You really need to step up to the plate. And on the one hand, there are pros and cons. I mean, I totally get where the business is coming from. They've got competitive pressures. They've got economic pressures. There's all these things going on. At the same time, it's also very, very difficult for IT to address some of these concerns sometimes and do so in a way that is appropriately compliant and appropriately secure, that sort of thing. So it can be challenging, no doubt about it.
I bring that up partly in jest, just remembering the golden age of IT. But realistically, I think there's a disconnect between those that are working in that new flavor of IT where there is no ops and there's no server and everything's amazing and super quick and instantaneous. They kind of forget about all this stuff that we're also being asked to support and provide and care and feed, you know, that 80-20 rule, which feels more like 100/20 rule. If you want to do any innovation, it has to be on your own time. And just acknowledging that it all exists and that this is a painful transition for a lot of folks being asked to reinvent and pivot while at the same time being asked to keep all of the existing operations alive. It's a challenge that I wanted to acknowledge.
Scott, as we look towards the future of things in the data center, you know, we kind of talked about the operational changes and, you know, how we're moving a lot faster. I want to ask you some networking specific questions, since that's a specialty of yours. So I'm going to bait you enormously because of who your employer is with this one. Are overlays the long-term future or an interim step? Now, NSX, of course, use overlays, and OpenStack, that's the traditional way that they're doing segmentation. Cisco ACI uses an overlay in parts to get between leaf and spine. They show up all over the place. I mean, is that what we have to do in networking to get things done, or are we going to transition to something else?
From a purely pragmatic perspective today, and I'll come back, I'll follow up on this sort of looking ahead, I think there are things that you can do with overlays that are both not possible without them and that offer real business value. So multi-tenancy is a great example, right? If you want to be able to offer somebody multi-tenant networking and have that isolation occur in such a way that they aren't forced to use a particular IP space or something of that nature, then as far as I'm aware, and Ethan, you know, you've got a much longer history in networking than I do, so feel free to correct me, overlays are kind of the answer here, right?
It's the answer for an IP network. It's straightforward and offshore. And if you don't have an MPLS infrastructure, that's pretty commonly what's been happening. We see VXLAN being used to achieve that. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, whether they become the answer, like the de facto thing moving the future, I think, in my opinion, really hinges on IPv6. There's been a lot of interest, rightfully so, to moving towards a fully routed sort of layer 3 network, right? So we have stuff like IPVLAN L3, making its appearance in containerized infrastructures. We have projects like Calico, and I think maybe some others that are, I know Calico does, or maybe some others that are that are doing, you know, sort of routing on the host and layer three all the way to the host. And that's how it works, right? You know, BGP and other routing protocols to distribute those routes. So there's a lot of interest in that. And that's great because that's a very, very scalable, very well-tested sort of approach. But yet at the same time, given current sort of situation with IPv4, that may not necessarily do the things that we need it to do. So in my mind, simplistically, perhaps I see whether overlays are going to become a de facto approach being partially based upon how quickly IPv6 continues to move into the rest of the networking world.
Let me ask yet another question here on the future of networking in the data centers. We've got a lot of competing networking approaches from vendors right now. This is one thing over the last 5 years, we've kind of charted this on the Packet Pushers podcast particularly. Man, we haven't rallied around a lot of standards as such where you go from vendor to vendor and see like one way to do things. And as a customer, you can look at it and go, yeah, this makes sense. This is the way I'm going to go ahead and be and you know, retool my networking because everybody's kind of banked on this way. There's a lot of different ways and most of them are incompatible. And it's great for competition, but it's hard for us customers to choose. I mean, how do you decide?
Yeah, that's certainly a great question. And in the early days, and I do consider it still early days yet for sort of network virtualization and overlay-based networks, you're going to see a lot of competing standards and a lot of different approaches. And until they become appropriately sort of commoditized, if you will, that there's no longer value for the individual vendors. You know, I think we're seeing increasing efforts around standardization on data plane pieces. And I think we have a fair amount of interoperability on the data plane. I think where most of the incompatibility comes is in control plane. And here you really run into sort of challenges around the CAP theorem. And when you mix approaches, you may have made different decisions around that CAP theorem. For example, you may have one who isn't as strongly geared around partitioning, and you mix that with a solution that is much more architected for partitioning. It's like, how do you mix those two sort of different architectures because they made different design decisions in an effort to address different needs within the networking space? I don't know if that makes any sense or not, or if I went like way too deep on that. But I think what we probably need to do as an industry, and just in my opinion, and of course, you know, I'm no expert, but I think we probably need to be pushing more for some approach of federation rather than trying to create interoperable control planes. I think it's too early yet for the vendors to be looking at interoperable control planes because the vendors still see a lot of value in their control plane. And I think that's fair. I mean, there is still a lot of differences in control plane and control plane scalability. And
okay. So the answer to that then would be abstractions, which we really seem to be big on that in certain corners, where you talk about networking intent and in various other ways. You put in some kind of an abstraction layer to kind of make these differences in control plane, as you point out, fade away and disappear. Well, it's not always about control plane, but fairly often. I mean, are all these abstraction layers we're putting in with these different projects, is that just adding complexity? Or is that maybe, I don't know, because I could argue that we should just be agreeing on how to do things the same. Do you have a take on that?
The sort of the ideal would be that we all agree to do things the same, but it leads me back to that XKCD comic, you know, where situation there are 14 competing standards and we need one, you know, situation there are not 15 competing standards, right?
That's right.
Yeah. You know, so until you can get the entire world to agree that we're all going to agree, you know, it's not really realistic. And as long as there is, just being totally realistic and totally pragmatic here, as long as there's an opportunity for an organization to quote unquote differentiate themselves through something that is unique to them, they're going to seek to do that, right? I mean, it's just kind of the nature of the world in which we live. So are abstractions the right way? I think that as we move towards a greater level of automation, a greater level of programmability across both networking hardware and across, let's say, you know, network virtualization solutions, not just NSX, but you know, there could be any number of solutions that are driven by Neutron or driven by others in that space. As we move to sort of greater levels of adoption of those, greater levels of automation on the network hardware, I think that what we're also seeing is the rise of these orchestration tools that sometimes are platform specific, sometimes are multi-platform, that begin to address some of these differences, right? So you'll take a look at OpenStack trying to do this themselves, like in ML2 within Neutron, so that you could have multiple plugins that would then be sort of managed by Neutron. And so some section might be using OVS ML2 plugins, some places might be using some other ML2 plugins, so on and so forth, right? Mixing and matching within OpenStack. But then how do you mix and match between OpenStack and, say, Amazon, or between OpenStack and, say, something else, right? Your quote-unquote legacy virtualization environment. This is where I think orchestration platforms become very, very powerful, because they can absorb some of those differences in a way that still offers value to the organization without necessarily adding great level of complexity. Is there some complexity added? Yes, of course.
But the burden's not on the customer typically to deal with that. It's on the orchestration vendor to sort those out and on integrations from other vendors to work with platforms. So yeah, I get your point.
Correct.
Love the conversation on networking. Want to kind of wrap on maybe some VMware commentary around what you're doing at the upcoming VMworld show. Any teasers or places and ways that folks can get a hold of you and talk nerdy about VMware stuff?
Sure. So I'll be at the show. I think I have a couple of group discussions that I'm going to be doing. I did one last year on containers. I usually am involved in the Meet the Experts thing as well. So if you want to sign up for a time slot and come in and chat about whatever topic, you can do that as well. Similar to last year, I think that we'll have another sort of super session. Last year's super session I did with my boss, Guido Appenzeller, who is the CTSO for the Network Security Business Unit. He's kind of the visionary for the product. And we showed off some very interesting stuff, which kicked off a number of discussions like NSX for AWS and these kinds of things, Ryan. We'll have a similar session this year where, again, we'll be showing off some interesting things. Obviously, I can't share any details yet because that would kind of spoil it. But you can look forward to that. I think too early to tell when exactly it's going to be, but it'll be probably Monday or Tuesday of the show.
Excellent. Yeah. No one wants any spoilers except we all kind of want some spoilers.
Yeah. And I'd love to give them to you. But honestly, I like my job. So.
All right. Fair enough. Well, we tried, loyal listeners. We tried. And that's it for today's edition of the Data Nauts podcast. Scott, really want to thank you for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to come on the show. If people want to get a hold of you or find more about where you're at on the interwebs, where can they reach you?
Sure. So thanks first for all the opportunity. I really enjoyed being able to hop on and chat with you guys. So you can hit my blog at blog.scottlow.org, @Scott_Low on Twitter. My GitHub ID is lowscott. So you can check out any of the repos or anything that I've done on GitHub. We did briefly mention the podcast, which is the Full Stack Journey podcast. We have on iTunes. If you search for Full Stack, you'll find it. Also available via the website at fullstackjourney.com.
Excellent. Hey, if you're a social creature, you can follow me. I'm @ChrisWall on the Twitters or via my blog, wallnetwork.com. And my delightful friend, Ethan, he's @ECBanks on the Twitters. And his blog is ethancbanks.com. For more of that delicious Data Nauts show that you love and crave, we talk about infrastructure engineering and all sorts of other fun topics, you can nosedive down the rabbit hole that is packetpushers.net. You'll find the Data Nauts talking about containers and conferences, certs, scripting, the cloud, full stack journeying and engineering, and storage architecture, plus so much more. Until then, my friends, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly managed.
Hang on a second, Scott. Your USB, you just went into Cylon mode.
Okay.
Destroy Robinson family. All hail our new Scott Low overlords. Do you write for a fortune cookie company or something on the side? What's the deal there, Scott?
Well, I was trying to keep that on the wraps, so to speak. But,
I love it.